Some of our members are small business owners, and they know the secret to success is usually just that, a secret. So we built American Express Open Forum, an online community that helps our members connect and share ideas to make smart business decisions. We built this for our members, but we made it open for everyone. Connect at openforum.com. This is what membership is. This is what membership does.
Today on Face the Nation, has the National Security Agency's electronic snooping gone beyond protecting us to invading our privacy? We'll talk to the former deputy director of the CIA, Michael Morell, who was part of an advisory panel that told the White House the time has come to put new controls on the spy agency. Then we'll continue a 65-year CBS News tradition.
We have brought in five CBS correspondents, men of great experience.
The Correspondent Roundtable.
I'm not doubting you experts on this.
Today, the correspondents are different. There are women, for one thing, but the conversation is about many of the same things. And on this last weekend before Christmas, we'll take a look at the year's best books and have a conversation with best-selling authors Terry McMillan. Her new one is Who Asked You? Mystery master Michael Conley, whose new one is The Gods of Guilt, plus George Saunders, author of 10th of December, and Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Rick Atkison, whose latest on World War II is The Guns at Last Light. Good books and the news, good and bad, because this is Face the Nation.
From CBS News in Washington, Face the Nation with Bob Schieffer.
And good morning again on this last weekend before Christmas. Well, as the controversy over whether the National Security Agency has gone too far and invaded privacy in its efforts to protect us from terrorist attack, a panel of experts appointed by the president to study the NSA's programs made 46 recommendations, including some that would rein in the agency. The former number two man at the CIA, Michael Morell, was on that panel. He joins us this morning. Mr. Morell, I must say a lot of official Washington was surprised when, number one, that the recommendations were unanimous and that you, as a longtime user of information collected by the NSA, said, yes, it may be time to change a few things. Tell us about your thinking.
Well, good morning, Bob, and thank you for inviting me. I think there's some very important context here that the American people need to understand. And there's two pieces to that context, I think. One is that there has not been a successful terrorist attack in the United States since 9/11. And there are a lot of reasons for that, and there are a lot of organizations and a lot of people who are responsible for that, and the National Security Agency is one of those agencies. And because of that, those officers who work there are patriots, and we are going to continue to need them to do the work they do because the threat continues to exist. And quite frankly, it's possible the threat could grow again. So that's one very important piece of context that Americans need to understand. The other is that there is this view out there that somehow the National Security Agency was out there on its own doing all of these things. Not the case. It was doing exactly what its government asked it to do. It was operating under strict rules provided by the executive branch and the judicial branch, and it was overseen extensively by the intelligence committees on Congress. There was no abuse here. They were doing exactly what they were told to do. I think that's important context for people to know.
Well, you say there was no abuse because they were doing what they were told to do. But are there instances, Mr. Morell, where they have invaded Americans' privacy, or is it that they just have the capability to do that?
So the key program here that we're talking about is the 215 program. Which is the ability of NSA to go in to that database and make sure that that terrorists overseas aren't in contact with anybody in the United States.
And you're talking about this collection of telephone numbers, basically, that the NSA has assembled.
So it's telephone numbers, which number called whom, when that occurred, and the duration of the call. That's it. No names attached to it, no content attached to it. And so that's the program. I think one of the misperceptions out there at the moment is that the review group did not see value in this program. And what the review group said is look, the program to date has not played a significant role in stopping terrorist attacks in the United States. But the review group also noted that going forward, it is important.
But let me just interrupt you here, because they have said, if I understand it, that yes, indeed, there have been numerous instances where they have prevented terrorist attacks. Is that, did you find evidence that that's true, or do you have questions about that?
So what we found when we looked at the data is out of the couple hundred times a year that NSA queries this database, that there are a dozen, 15 times a year where they have tipped information to the FBI, where they have said, look, this is something we think you need to look at. That's important. I think the best way to describe this, Bob, is that if you have a terrorist overseas who is being monitored by a foreign government, and if that terrorist says, I want to conduct an attack in the United States, or he is undertaking some sort of attack and you don't know where that attack's going to be, it is very important for our government to be able to look into that database to see whether that terrorist overseas is talking to anybody in the United States.
So is what the panel recommending is that they stop collecting this data?
So what we're recommending is that because this program remains important, okay, perhaps not as important as some have said, but because it remains important, it's important for the government to continue to be able to query this data. Mm-hmm. What the panel is saying is, in order to better protect privacy and civil liberties, which is an important concern here, we believe two things. We believe that the government should not hold this data any longer. We leave it an open question who should, but we say the government shouldn't hold this data. Somebody else should. The second thing we say is that NSA should have to get a court order for every individual time they want to query this data, not operate under a blanket court order. We think that better protects privacy and civil liberties, while at the same time allowing the government to do what it needs to do to protect the country.
But what you're saying, and if I understand what the people at the agency have said, is that would take a lot of time if you had to do this individually, go in and get these court orders one at a time, as it were.
Yeah, so that's an important issue. That's an important issue. You know, in terms of what would have to happen under our recommendations, NSA would have to prepare a justification to go to the FISA court. The FISA court would have to review that justification and say yes or no. That's probably a 2-3-4 day process, right? If the government decides that the telecommunications company should hold this data, then you're probably talking about a couple more days as the government goes to each one individually. My preference is to create some sort of private consortia that holds all of this data. And so once you have that court order, you can go to that private company and get an answer very, very quickly. That's my preference. So I think you're adding 2-3-4 days at most. We also said that there should be an emergency exception. So if you have to move quickly, you can do so without a court order. Perhaps you need the Attorney General's approval and get that court order later. So we don't think we have significantly undermined the government's ability to protect the country, while at the same time we think we've enhanced privacy and civil liberties significantly.
Let me just ask you two questions. Number one, I think I asked you this before. Has the NSA violated anyone's privacy?
No.
You do not believe
so? I do not believe that.
At this point?
The NSA is not spying on Americans. I think that is a perception that some have out there. It is not focused on any single American. It is not reading the content of your phone calls or my phone calls or anybody else's phone calls. It is focused on this metadata for one purpose only, and that is to make sure that foreign terrorists aren't in contact with anybody in the United States.
And this question, this whole conversation is taking place because of these disclosures by Snowden, who defected to Russia. There has been some suggestion that perhaps he should be given some sort of amnesty in order to bring him back here and maybe stop future leaks. Do you think the president should give him some sort of amnesty?
No, I do not. And I feel strongly about that. He violated the trust put in him by the United States government. He has committed a crime, in my view. You know, a whistleblower doesn't run. A whistleblower does not disclose information that has nothing to do with what he says his cause is, which is the privacy and civil liberties of Americans. You know, if I could talk to Mr. Snowden myself, what I would say is, Edward, you say you're a patriot. You say you want to protect the privacy and civil liberties of Americans. You say that you wanted Americans to have a debate about this and to make up their mind about what to do about this. Well, if you really believe that, if you really believe that Americans should be the judge of this program, then you should also believe that the Americans should be the judge of your behavior in this regard. So if you are the patriot that you say you are, you should come home and be judged.
Mike Morrell, thank you very much. Wish you the best of the season.
Thanks
for joining us.
Thanks, Bob.
We'll be back in 1 minute with our annual CBS News Correspondents Year-End Roundup. Joining us now as we continue our 65-year tradition here at CBS News, bringing correspondents in at the end of the year to talk about the news of the year. David Martin, I think you were the first one. No, you weren't. I'm teasing.
What an easy joke.
Here's our
national
security
guard.
Okay. Margaret Brennan covers the State Department, and congressional correspondent Nancy Cortes and Chief Washington correspondent Major Garrett round out our group today. Let's just start right in, Garrett, because you pressed the president pretty hard at his news conference Friday about this idea of somehow giving amnesty to Edward Snowden.
Or a plea bargain or some sort of arrangement.
Do you think that the president is actually considering something like that?
Not presently, but those around him are, and it's a live topic. I think it's going to become more lively as this year goes on. It's hard to look at the panel's recommendation to the president or Justice Leon's decision earlier this week from the U.S. District Court and not look at the disclosures as something that has set in motion not only a political debate but a constitutional debate about the scope of U.S. surveillance, everything that is done in counterterrorism in the name of preventing terrorism that has touched upon average American lives in ways that may, in fact, be legitimate from a counterterrorism point of view but are not viewed entirely legitimate by Americans once they were disclosed. That's an ongoing topic that will be part of the legislative debate on Capitol Hill. The president in mid-January is going to announce his own changes that he can carry out by himself to this surveillance program. But I think as the year goes on, Edward Snowden, his fate, whether there's a plea deal or amnesty, is going to become a political topic, a lively judicial topic, and something the president's going to have to decide
on. Well,
I
would say that would be the understatement of the year, that it will become a political topic. I think Capitol Hill would explode if the president somehow decided to give amnesty. I mean, can you imagine every single Democrat running for re-election would have to be answer the question, do you think the president's right to give amnesty to Edward Snowden? I think it would create a political situation that would simply be untenable.
Not to mention the red meat that it would give to Republicans as they go into this election year. And it's been really fascinating to watch the evolution on Capitol Hill over the course of the year on this issue. At the very beginning, you know, when these revelations first came out from Snowden, the overwhelming reaction was, how dare he? Bring him back. He's a traitor. And I think a lot of people still feel that way. But as they started to hear from their constituents about what they felt was an intrusion into their privacy, you saw more and more members join the few who had been out there in the beginning, the Ron Wydens, the Rand Pauls, saying, we think that this program needs to be reined in. We're not comfortable with it. And that's why when these new recommendations came out this week about the NSA, there was sort of like a, huh, yeah, that's about what we thought. You know, there are a lot of members who are glad that this is being tackled.
David.
You know, the president said this is a conversation we needed to have. Raise your hand if you think we would have had this conversation without Edward Snowden.
Impossible.
It's hard to know what to think about the guy. Is he a traitor or is he a whistleblower who did the American public a service? And you can preach that flat around. I find it inconceivable that he will be granted blanket amnesty. But a plea bargain to a lesser sentence, I can see.
I think the president's going to have to be very, very careful about this, because after all, what would this say to the next person who thinks maybe it would be a good idea to dump a bunch of information out there, when he would say, oh, okay, well, I can go ahead and do this, and in the end, they'll forgive me or something. I just don't think that'll happen. What do you think, Margaret?
Well, I think there are two sort of bigger takeaways from this entire incident, which is, one, add to the list of things that Russia can say has helped make it a player of consequence once again on the world stage, and certainly taking in Edward Snowden was one of them. And secondly, and perhaps more profoundly in terms of long-term implication, will be the damage to alliance management. Alliance management is one of the key foreign policy tools of this administration. That means just getting everyone on board at the same time, whether it's about Iran, whether it's about any of the other challenges out there. And this really undermines trust along the lines of our European partners and others around the world.
And one of the things that's significant that was learned this week that the American public can digest on its own, in Judge Leon's ruling where he said it was likely unconstitutional, this blanket holding and collection of data, he said the government, given many opportunities, could not cite a single instance when this surveillance stopped or thwarted an emerging terrorist attack. The panel's recommendations also said we have not found conclusively where this has stopped a terrorist attack from happening. That's not information the American public had before, and that's going to increase the intensity of this debate, the utility of this particular kind of surveillance, and what role Edward Snowden played in releasing it.
But Mike Morrell will tell you that if this metadata program had been in effect on September 10th, 2001, it would have stopped or had a very good chance of stopping 9/11. So even though there is no case where this one program was the difference between a successful and an unsuccessful attack, there is evidence out there that it is useful.
Let's talk about the year in Washington. I must say, I can't think of a worse year that Washington has gone through, with the possible exception of Watergate, of course, which is kind of off by itself. What is going to happen on Obamacare now, Nancy? Is this program going to finally happen? I mean, are people going to be enrolled, or are there still problems here?
Well, I think our first test will be January 1st, when people have their new insurance programs. If they go to the hospital, if they go to their doctor, are they going to be able to get reimbursed? Are they going to be able to see the doctor that they want to see? And it's really still an open question. And this is really a challenge, I think, in particular. It's an understatement for Democrats, who are really in a bind. I mean, they have supported this. They have taken the slings and arrows on Obamacare for 4 years now. So they can't turn their backs on it. You know, it's their main accomplishment, and it's the president's main accomplishment. On the other hand, they do need to show that they think the program needs to be fixed. And going into an election year, every single one of them at some point in the past few years has said, if you like your doctor, you can keep him. If you like your plan, you can keep it. And you have to know that every Republican has found them saying that. They've got the tape, and they're going to be turning that into ads come this fall.
Of course, the other big story of the year was the shutdown of the government. I guess we're not going to see another of those for a while.
No. We have 2 years of budget peace, and that really is a reflection of the politics of exhaustion. The White House was exhausted by the Obamacare rollout fiasco. Republicans were exhausted by the shutdown and getting nothing out of it. And the Speaker, John Boehner, told his members, we're not going to get anything out of this. They said, Mr. Speaker, run into the buzzsaw yet again. He did it one last time, and then, as we saw, to create this 2 years of budget peace, said never again. And not only am I going to say never again, I'm going to call out the critics who want me to run into that buzzsaw again. Those politics are over. So I would say this was a down year as far as production, but it ended in a way that offers some degree of optimism for the White House and Capitol Hill that some things can get done. The National Defense Authorization Act was passed. That's a huge piece of legislation that will give the Pentagon some certainty for a while. 2 years of budget peace also allows a shutdown scenario to be completely wiped off the boards. The one last remaining element is, do we have a default crisis? Every political indicator at the White House and the Hill suggests we won't. So though it was a dreadful year productively, it ended in a way that gives both sides some sense that a midterm year will be calmer.
Let me ask David and Margaret. David, both of you, what will be the big stories on your beats this year at defense and at state?
Well, I think Syria is going to be a huge story. particularly if these chemical weapons, serious chemical weapons, are destroyed as planned. Because all along, the absolute worst-case scenario in Syria has been those chemical weapons falling into the hands of radical Islamists. If you take those chemical weapons off the table, then that opens up a lot of actions that the U.S. could take to change the balance of power without having the dire consequence of those weapons falling into the wrong hands. Because right now, they just are afraid of Syria imploding. But you get those chemical weapons out of there, and the consequences just aren't as dire. However, I don't think they're going to do anything, the administration, until all of the chemical weapons are out, until the peace conference scheduled for January in Geneva has run its course.
Mm-hmm. Margaret?
Well, I would agree with Dave that Syria is going to be a story, and I think it's going to be the story for the next decade or more to come because of the consequences for the region. I think David's prediction there in terms of lack of action may be right. There is opportunity. There have been numerous opportunities over almost 3 years of conflict now. But we do know January 22nd, something will happen in Switzerland with these peace talks, but the question is still, who's going to show up to the table? Assad has not shown himself to be the statesman that people had thought he might be able to be with the Russians pushing him towards the table. The U.S. still doesn't want Iran at the negotiating table, yet arguably their influence has increased in Syria. And the U.S. has decided, instead of picking a side and let's make sure they win, let's pick a side, give them moderate support, and see how they do. And the consequence of that has been the rebels fracturing. So
all right.
We
in
don't
a
know.
A couple of sentences. What is your prediction for the new year, starting with Major?
The administration will approve the Keystone XL pipeline. John Podesta will use his power within the White House to create executive orders for the president, both on environmental regulation and economics, that will please the left displeased by the Keystone decision.
Nancy. If Congress manages to do something big this year, and it's a big if, it will be immigration. It has already passed in the Senate. It'll look very different in the House, but members want to be able to show their constituents they have accomplished something going into the midterm elections, and they're not going to be able to tackle something like tax reform. The trust just
David.
Isn't there.
The U.S. will sign a security agreement with Afghanistan and decide to keep about 5,000 troops there past 2014.
Margaret.
John Kerry has to become a closer. He's got to be Hamid Karzai's therapist, get him to sign that deal. He's got to get something done by April with the Israelis and Palestinians. He has to get the Syria peace conference going January 22nd. And we got 6 months to go with Iran here.
All right. And I predict that the president will not give amnesty to Edward Snowden. Back in a minute with some personal thoughts.
Good night and good luck.
If you were gathering news Friday, you wouldn't have needed a very large sack to take away what you found at the president's get-out-of-town news conference. You knew he wasn't in for an easy ride when the first question was this your worst year? He sidestepped a direct answer. He said this was a time of year to reflect and thought he would have some better ideas after some sleep and sun. Congress had an even worse year than the president, but ended on an appropriate note, a long and loud debate over the rules. Democratic leader Harry Reid was hospitalized for exhaustion. He's fine now. But as the brief bipartisanship generated by the budget bill evaporated, South Carolina's Lindsey Graham said, "If this is kumbaya, I'd hate to see truly dysfunctional." Maybe they'll have some better ideas, too, after some sleep and sun. Surveying the mess that Washington left behind, the Wall Street Journal's Peggy Noonan said the word of the year was botched. I thought it was selfie, which reminds me, the news wasn't all bad. Anthony Weiner's political comeback went nowhere. And at last report, the social media seemed to be trending against using cell phones to talk on airplanes. Now that is news to make us feel downright warm and fuzzy. Back in a minute. Some of our stations are leaving us now, but we'll be right back with Page Two. You know, one of the things we all agree on here at Face the Nation is that we all love the news, but the other thing is we all really love a good book. And sometimes when the news is so bad, we don't even like to talk about it. I advise people just go read a good book. So we thought we'd gather some of our favorite authors today, all of whom have new books out this year, to talk about books and writing. Michael Connelly has written 18 Harry Bosch mysteries, and The Gods of Guilt is his new one about the Lincoln lawyer. Terry McMillan, who wrote How Stella Got Her Groove Back and Waiting to Exhale, has a new one out called Who Asked You? George Saunders writes short stories. His new collection is the 10th of December, and it's on the New York Times Book Review's top 10 list for 2013. And finally, our old friend Rick Atkison, who I knew when he used to be just a reporter. And now he is a Pulitzer Prize winner. He has finished his Liberation trilogy, The Guns at Last Light, which focuses on Western Europe and the end of World War II. His series, An Army at Dawn, as I say, his book, The Army at Dawn, won the Pulitzer, and we're honored to have all of you here today. You know, I was just sitting here, and I want to talk to each of you about your books, but I was just sitting here thinking about the year that President Obama has had. It's been just an awful book for everybody concerned in Washington. So he's gone off on vacation. Terry, you have a book he ought to read while he's resting. He says he's going to think and sleep and try to get some good ideas.
I would say All Over But the Shouting by Rick Bragg. It's a memoir, but I think the title sort of says it all.
I know Rick, and I have read that book.
It's a wonderful book.
That's a pretty good one. Michael?
Well, it is vacation, so I was going to give him some light reading. There's a new author out in L.A. Named P.G. Sturgis, and he writes these books called The Shortcut Man. And it's just about a guy who doesn't really have a job. He's not a cop or a detective, but he somehow finds a way to get things done, and maybe that could be inspiring.
Well, I'm happy to say I've read that book, too, and it is it's a terrific book. I didn't know about him until that book came along.
I would have the president read a book called High-Rise Stories, edited by Audrey Petty, and it's a beautiful kind of Studs Terkel-esque book about Chicago housing projects through the 60s through the 80s, and maybe just as a way of reminding ourselves that progress happens, but sometimes there's a slog first, and yeah, it's a great book.
Rick?
I would have him read a book by my former colleague at the Washington Post, David Finkel, called Thank You for Your Service. It's about soldiers coming back from Iraq. It's pretty bleak, but it is a beautiful narration of what we've asked these soldiers to do, and it's a counterpoint to David's earlier book, The Good Soldiers, which is about the same battalion in Iraq in 2008. And I think that every lawmaker, including the president, should read both those books.
You know, I always ask authors this because I wondered about it myself, and that is, why did you decide to write a book? And I'll be very honest, when I sat down to try to do it the first time, I just did it to see if I could, and I guess I did. But whatever the case, Terry, why did you turn to writing books?
Well, because there are a lot of things that I saw happening to people around me, and not just people that I knew, but people that, I'll put it this way, I think that I was tired of watching people suffer, and I wanted to try to see if I could fix it. And so I found out that I could reinvent their lives, including my own, and find some kind of salvation for them.
Michael, I've gotten so much pleasure out of your books, and I must say, I think I've read all the Harry Bosch books, not all of the Lincoln Lawyer books, but being an old police reporter myself, why did you turn to books? Because I know you used to be a police reporter.
Yeah, I think it was, I was always a voracious reader. I was covering crime, but I was reading fictional crime, and I think the inspirational moment for me was Chapter 13 of The Little Sister by Raymond Chandler. And it's a chapter that has nothing to do with plot. It's all about character and this guy driving around Los Angeles, written in the 1940s, and it still speaks to the city. And I thought, to write something that can last that long, that's art. And it just inspired me to say, I want to someday try to do that.
George, I know you did a couple of things before you got to writing
books. I did,
including working on an oil rig in Sumatra.
Yeah, I was kind of, I came to it a little slowly, but I got, the first bug was when I was in third grade. A nun gave me a copy of Johnny Tremaine by Esther Forbes, and it was the most explosively beautiful experience to read that book, and that's when I never felt as alive as I did when I was reading. So then through all these engineering years, I kept thinking, you know, I really like reading and writing. I wonder if that's a job, you know. And finally, I realized it was the only one I was fit to do, so I kind of came to that. But I think it's the, for me, it's the feeling of being able to communicate at that beautifully high level you can in prose, where you actually make a connection with another person that you've never met, mm-hmm. that assumes the best of them. And for that little zone, you're kind of your best self. I feel like that anyway. So it's a very sweet, kind of wonderful experience.
And Rick, you and I knew each other back to the Pentagon days when you were a reporter here mm-hmm. in Washington. How did you finally decide this is what you want to do?
Well, I came out of the newspaper business, as you yourself came out of the news business as a print reporter a long time ago. I was looking for an opportunity to do long-form narrative, and I write about war, and I find that the incredible stress of combat is a great revealer of character. Hmm. It flays open the inner self in the same way a prism flays open a beam of light. You see the inner spectrum. And I found that writing books and having that opportunity to have a deeper, longer voice in book writing was really the only way to fully express the extraordinary stress that combat brings to men, and now men and women. And the book form allows me to do things that no other form permit.
Terry, I'm so envious of people who write fiction. I've tried. I just don't get it. And my editor said to me one time, well, some people remember things and write them down, and some people make things up. When you are writing your books, do you make them up, or are they about you? Tell me about this new book, and what is your personal connection to the characters in this book?
Well, you know, to write fiction, you have to be a good liar. And I lie on paper. I'm not a very good liar in person. My new book is primarily about a grandmother who is forced to raise her grandchildren, and also about people who are always sticking their nose in someone else's business and offering unsolicited advice, which most of us know people like that, and what to do, how to process that, and who to listen to and who to ignore. So that's pretty much it. And you know, I deal with racial issues, love, taking care of a spouse that's ill. But mostly for me, it's about struggling and how to survive when things are working against you.
I think your work cuts through, and I think so many people identify with it. Is that what you're doing? Are you trying to reach people and say, look, I know things are tough there, but here's something that might help you understand where you are? And
well, I think that that's one of the reasons why I read fiction in general, or specifically, I should say, because I don't read books that are just about black people. I think that a lot of our stories sort of transcend that. Mm-hmm. Because we're all struggling for the same thing, which is to be happy and to find joy and peace and all that. But I think that there are stories out here that I tell that happen to be about African Americans. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people, I mean, I read books by everybody. Mm-hmm. And I think that there is a commonality that all of us share, and that is we suffer the same. We love the same, mm-hmm. and some of us do and don't see beauty the same, but for the most part, we're all striving for the same thing.
Michael, is Harry Bosch you?
No, not at all, but also I've been able to write about him over 20 years, so when starting out, he wasn't like me at all. He was almost a writing exercise, what it would be like to spend time with a character completely different. But I got lucky, that book got published, and they asked for another one. And now over 20 years, it's hard to keep that separation. So we share a lot now. We have 16-year-old daughters, and so there, you know, used to be an arm's length. Now I'm slowly putting my arm around them, and so there's a lot of commonalities.
And you've just finished a TV series. Well, actually, it's going to be streamed, isn't it, by Amazon about Harry?
Yeah, we just finished filming a couple days ago.
And are you excited about that? How much of a part did you play in the screenwriting?
Well, I played a lot because in the screenwriting and in the whole production, because I've been, like I said, my whole fiction writing career has been wrapped around this character. So I said, like, if you want my books, I come with them, and you know, I'm going to have a say. And that, they were receptive to that. So if it's good, it's my fault. If it's bad, it's my fault. But I think it's going to be good.
You know, George, I must say, and I think somebody said the nicest thing that anybody could say about a writer as I was reading about you. It said about you, he seems to be in touch with some better being. He writes like a saint. Nobody has said that about me. How does that make you feel to be described in that way?
Well, it means I have to stop shoplifting now. That's one of the bad things. No, I think actually that's what writing, it lets the reader and the writer be in touch with some better being. Because from the writer's point of view, as you're working through your drafts, your first draft might be a bit of a cartoon, and you're dissatisfied. So you come back and you say, you know, I'm not being fair to this character. You try again. And again and again. And over those many drafts, the person becomes more multifaceted. And in the process, you're doing sort of scale model empathy practice, you know. And I think the same thing with a reader. A reader gets into someone else's head, essentially, and is reassured that that distant person also has love and hope and fear, and that the things that matter to the reader also matter to the writer. So it's that process that puts us all in touch with something better.
I'm going to say that one of the things, the best things I think you've ever written, and I just came to it last night as I was reading through some of the things about you, and it is a graduation speech that you wrote. And when you talked about a failure of kindness, mm-hmm. and I thought, you know, someone has written a graduation speech or two himself over the years and listened to a bunch of them. I thought, what a wonderful message. What did you really mean by that?
Well, I first wrote that speech for my daughter's middle school class, and in that urgency of talking to people that you know and care about, I thought, well, what's really true? What, after all these years, what do I really think? What do I regret? Not much, actually. But a handful of times where, for whatever selfish reason, I didn't rise to the occasion and be as gentle or as kind as I could have been. And I thought, well, that's kind of a strange thing, maybe a little frothy, you know, but it was really true. And I think the response to that speech indicates that a lot of people feel that way, that the best self is over here. And every so often in real life, we don't quite come up to that level. And as the years go by, those moments can be a little bit bitter, actually, you know, in retrospect. So
it made me reflect back on my own life. And I must say I had some of the same feelings. Rick, what do you do now? You've written these three enormous books, and they're page turners, and yet they're big books, a three-volume history of the war in Europe. What do you do next?
Well, I'm moving back in time. I'm moving into the 18th century, and I'm doing another trilogy, but this on the American Revolution. For me, the opportunity to write about World War II, first of all, it's the greatest catastrophe in human history, 60 million dead. Yet the liberation of Europe is the greatest story of the 20th century, with characters that are so rich and deep beyond the abilities of even these extraordinary fiction writers to invent, and not just Eisenhower and Patton and Omar Bradley and Churchill and Montgomery, but others who've been lost to history. And so trying to resuscitate them to... You know, I believe that the narrative nonfiction writer's true calling is to bring back the dead. And so I'm going to try and do that with the 18th century, and particularly looking at the British, whom I think are absolutely fascinating. We tend to caricature them as Americans, and they're extraordinary characters. They're extraordinarily accomplished. And the Germans, who are here in force, beginning in 1776, as well as the Americans who fought the rebellion. And so that's what I'm going to do now, Bob.
All right, well, we're going to take a break and come back and talk a lot more about all of this in just a minute. Well, we're back with our authors. Let me just ask all of you, what's the best book you read this year, Rick?
Well, I go back to Finkel's book, Thank You for Your Service. I think that is an extraordinary book. It sat with me. I finished it, reading it in a restaurant in New York several weeks ago. The waitress was French, and she asked me whether there was something wrong with my dinner because I was in tears. And a book that can do that and sticks with you. I think, you know, I read lots of books about war, but this is a book that transcends the genre.
Do you read much nonfiction?
I do, actually. As I'm getting older, somehow it's more urgent, I think, somehow. Mm-hmm. I'm reading Arthur Miller's autobiography right now, which is really an incredible sort of mini-seminar in the 20th century, the progress in the arts, and a really wonderful reminder of the McCarthy years and how real that was and how it hasn't really gone away. So that's been a lot of pleasure, that book.
Michael, what do you have time to read? And sometimes authors tell me, I get so engrossed in my book, I don't have time to read. And that's the thing, the real drawback to writing a book.
There are times in the process for my writing that I don't want to read anything, but you have to read. It's, you know, mm-hmm. It puts gas in your tank. I would say I'm reading more narrative nonfiction than fiction, and probably my favorite book was a book called Act of War by Jack Cheevers, and it just came out a couple weeks ago, and it's about the Pueblo incident in 1968, and, you know, through his FOI reports he got, he's really kind of recreated two great stories, the story on the high seas of the spy ship being taken by the North Koreans, and what was going on in Washington with Lyndon Johnson, and brought them together for a very, what seems like a riveting read, a page-turner, but it's history.
What about you, Tim?
Well, so far, I guess there are not very many days left in the year, but Louise Edrich's book, the novel The Roundhouse, moved me to no end because of how far... it's about familial love and how far someone is willing to go to correct an injustice. And I write about, most of us, I think, write about injustices. And hers happens to deal with Native Americans, which didn't matter to me, but I found it riveting. And I was in tears also at the end, and I actually threw the book across the room just because I was so excited about how it ended. Uh-huh. And she's a brilliant writer.
You know, do you all read on Kindles, or do you like to read in books?
I read real books.
Me too.
Yeah. I like to turn the page.
You know, I do too. But the one book this year, there was a book called The Last Lion, which was William Manchester's last book in that trilogy. He died before he was able to finish it. It was finished by a guy named Paul Reed. And I finally had to switch to a Kindle because the book was so heavy. I couldn't balance it on my stomach when I was sleeping at night. So I do take my Kindle when I go on vacation. You can take a lot of books that you couldn't otherwise. Yeah. But I'm like you. I like to hold the book. I like to smell the book. I like to just...
Yeah. Mark it up.
It's a book. And to me, nothing will ever take the place of that. What do you all think the future of books is? It seems to me that e-books kind of leveled off the sale of e-books this year. And
I think it's unfortunate. I mean, we have so much technology now in our lives. The one thing we do have left is a book that it's tactile. You can touch it.
Yeah.
And, you know, to put your Kindle on the floor in the bathroom or by the tub, what are you risking? Mm-hmm. I love leaning back and falling asleep with a book. And plus, on book tour, when people have handed me their Nooks and their Kindles, I just say, you know, I can't sign that. And I'm not going to. Oh, please, Miss McMillan. I'm like, no.
You do a selfie, though.
Pardon?
You do a selfie.
No. I'm not signing a Kindle.
Well, I think it's an interesting thing of you know, evolution. I mean, I think, and I have no scientific data for this, I think there's more readers now because of the convenience of these devices. It's not my personal taste. I actually have a Kindle and have all my books on it because it's easy to find stuff that you got to go back and find if you're writing a continuing character. So it's a tool for me. I think you're right. I think it's slowly hitting an equilibrium. And hopefully the book business, the bookstores will not go away, because I think everybody here I would not be here if it wasn't for bookstores and people doing the age-old practice of saying, you got to read this book, and handing a book to someone. And that is getting lost. And hopefully we're reaching a point that what we have now is going to stay.
I think a book forces you to kind of slow down. And I mean, in this age of Twitter and all this instant communication, I think it's good every once in a while to just kind of step back. And I think books do kind of help us.
You know, it's
do
funny because a book is actually not just the words. It's a really efficient data delivery system. And if you have a good designer, they actually are bringing another level of meaning with even things like the layout, the font, the cover, the feel. I remember reading when I was first writing, getting a 1910 copy of de Maupassant's short stories and going down to a river in Colorado and reading it. And I can still remember where certain passages were in the layout. And the physicality of the book made it an even more beautiful experience. I don't think we'd want to give up that element of it.
Rick?
I think the future of the book depends in large measure on the future of authors. And, you know, if authors can turn out things people want to read, regardless of whether it's in the dead tree edition of a process that's been around for 500 years or whether it's delivered electronically somehow, as long as there's good storytelling going on, fiction, nonfiction, otherwise, I'm very optimistic about it, and I do think that there is a physical experience in holding a book in your hands. And for me, I read a lot of nonfiction, and I mark it up, and I make notes in the margins and so on. And that's a kind of interaction that is hard to do electronically, but if someone's having an emotional experience with the essence of that book, I don't care how they're reading it.
You know, I think all of you are right, but Rick, it is still about content. Whether it's a television broadcast, whether it's a movie, whether it's a book, whether it's a high school graduation speech, it's the content, not how you dress it up. And I try to remember that around here. I want to thank all of you. It's a lot of fun to get to talk
thank
to you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for coming. We'll be right back. We note today the passing, and we note it with sadness, of 17-year-old Claire Davis, who died last night after spending 8 days in a coma after the shooting at Arapahoe High School in Colorado. There have been 28 school shootings over the last 12 months. We were told she loved horses, loved her life, and was loved by her parents and friends. Our heart goes out. And that's it for us. We want to thank you for being with us this morning. We hope you will stay with CBS. We hope that you will catch CBS This Morning tomorrow morning with Charlie Rose and Nora O'Donnell and Gail King. They'll have the very latest. That's it for us. See you later.
This has been Face the Nation with CBS News Chief Washington Correspondent Bob Schieffer. Today's guests were former CIA Acting Director Michael Morell, plus annual roundtables of correspondents and authors. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. The senior producer is Rob Hendon, and the producer is Emily Bradley. This broadcast was directed by Sue Ann Stockey-Wayne. Face the Nation originates from CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com. And you can follow Face the Nation, Bob Schieffer, and CBS Radio News on Twitter, Google+, and Facebook.